I wanna get locked up tonight. Listen to Rob Ross and get rock on my on the only podcast that I'll hear. Rip off my ears. Oh, the rock show, 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 the rock show. Oh, I want the rock show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 192 of The Rock Show. Today, we have a very special show. It's a two-parter about the band Led Zeppelin, one of the best bands of all time, biggest bands of all time. We're going to do a little in-depth information about both of on both these episodes. And Rob, you had something you wanted to say before we started.
Yeah, so I'd like to give a shout out to the Micro Wrestling Federation. They got the first show now on Discovery Channel every Tuesday at 10 p.m. You can watch the Micro Wrestling. So behind the scene, how these guys live, you know, survive on the road, getting along with other little people. So it's a pretty entertaining show. And it started on Tuesday. So every Tuesday night, Discovery Channel, 10 p.m. Watch it or be square. So it's very entertaining. I saw the first episode, and Jack came out looking good.
You know some of these guys, right?
Yeah, no, I hang out with those guys.
Yeah, you know these micro wrestlers.
I know the Vince McMahon on micro wrestling. So
I'll never forget that time a couple years ago, that New Year's Eve.
Oh yeah, they came around and jumped.
That was classic.
So let's get to the business we are going to talk about. Led Zeppelin, Robert Plant,
Jimmy Page,
and the
John
history.
Paul Jones and John Bonham.
But does the history go back all the way to the Yardbirds? Was the Yardbirds the beginning of this great supergroup?
Absolutely, absolutely.
It is a supergroup, right, Mike?
I mean, absolutely. They're definitely. Definitely a super group. I mean, they were in other bands before, and obviously Page was in the Yardbirds. It really kind of all goes back to that. John Paul Jones and Jimmy Page were well-known session musicians. They played on a lot of people's records before even the Yardbirds and Zeppelin was a thought. They were well-respected musicians.
Jimmy Page was like a hired gun.
He was a hired gun, exactly. It's a good term. Let me ask you something, Rob. When you know, in your life, when you were getting into music and stuff like that, what did you think of Led Zeppelin, your younger years?
You know, when I first heard them, I didn't know what to make out of them because they were like, it was something very different from anything you hear, because it was like rock and roll, but then it had like that little element of metal, and it also had that little element of punk. Like they put everything combined and they made it to this genre that's just Led Zeppelin. Like they got a little bit of everything. They could jam, they can play a slow song, they can play a metal song. Like these guys touch everything. It's pretty crazy how much they were very diversified, and they were all excellent musicians, you know?
Absolutely. Now,
Jimmy Page could play for a rock band and then go play the blues with some.
No, he could do anything, Jimmy Page.
Anything.
Absolutely. And you know, John Bonham is one of the greatest drummers of all time. In fact, all of them individually are considered one of the greatest of what they do. Plant, one of the greatest vocalists. Page, one of the greatest guitarists. John Paul Jones, one of the best bassists and keyboardists. And also John Bonham on drums. People cite him as the best. I'm going to make a little confession here. That's the first album. We'll get to that in a little bit. In my early years, I liked some songs, but for the most part, I used to kind of dump on them. And it was really because I was coming out of the punk scene and the hardcore scene in New York.
Of course.
And you know, Zeppelin kind of represented that, like, excess 20-minute solo shit that nobody I knew could ever achieve.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And, it, you know, obviously you grow out of that. I did by the 90s. But I, you know, I'll confess that I did used to shit on them. And of course the radio didn't help, because by the time classic rock was a thing in the 80s, they were just playing the same 10 songs, and they still play the same 10 songs by Zeppelin. It's, nothing's changed on the radio. But I'll just say, boy, was I wrong, because there was a point in the 90s where I kind of turned around entirely with this band and, you know, really started to appreciate the other songs and digging deep and realizing, understanding what they were doing. I mean, they were doing something that was never done before. They're as original as the Beatles, as original as the Stones. You know, they were basically to the 70s what the Beatles were to the 60s.
But you know what the thing with them, they were also like their own genre. Like, you couldn't put them anywhere. Like, they were just, yeah, they had such a different sound, and they were, and they even from the vocal to the way that they played the music, it was very different than just mellow rock and roll. Like, it was like their own thing. Like, I couldn't put Led Zeppelin in any genre. Like, I could just be like, they're Led Zeppelin. Think about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody that sounded like them before, and there's nobody that sounded like them since. People try.
Yeah.
People try, I mean, but they just don't get, you know, I mean, one band that I remember everyone was like, the second coming of Zeppelin was Whitesnake. Okay.
Yeah,
and
that.
I never bought into it. I mean, yeah, they were heavy, and Coverdale, David Coverdale kind of resembled Robert Plant a little bit.
Here I go again.
Yeah, no, but you know, people were calling them the second coming. And I was like, nah, there's quite a bit that's missing there.
What, but let me get a little more like little, metal.
I mean, they you know, Rob, they're considered forefathers of heavy metal. I don't really like that title 100%.
I don't think they were metal. They were more like rock and roll. They weren't like heavy metal. Like Motley Crue was more heavy metal than them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Black Sabbath is given that category too.
Black Sabbath,
you know, I guess I would say more Black Sabbath than Zeppelin, but there's elements of it.
You know what's the closest thing to Led Zeppelin? Might be Pink Floyd.
No. Nah.
But Pink Floyd got that weird thing. Like,
well, you know, there's, well, I mean, they definitely, you know, Zeppelin had a, especially the early years, had a psychedelic thing going through it.
Pink Floyd was
they would get away from that. They would get away from that by the mid-70s, where Pink Floyd went in a totally different direction. So
Pink Floyd went total psychedelic, but when you first heard both of them, you pretty much saw they were very close to.
I always felt Zeppelin was way heavier than Floyd, just more bombastic, you know?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, in the beginning, like, if you heard both, these guys are like, but then they definitely, once later on, they just went in separate, you know, they went separate ways, but I think the closest thing, like in those days, I would have think Pink Floyd was like, the psychedelic music. But yeah, that Zeppelin did stop the psychedelic real quick and just went to like rock and roll. And it's like the same thing, like the Rolling Stone, you know, you can call them metal, you can call them rock, but they're pretty much blues when you think of the Rolling Stone. They're really a blues band that played rock and roll.
Well, I would never include metal with the Stones, but you're right. They're blues. Oriented, you know.
But there's people that call them metal, like, you know.
I wouldn't agree with that.
They have no idea. That doesn't mean anything. It's like, to me, they're like rock and roll.
Yeah, they're rock and roll, and Zeppelin is rock and roll too. And they were interesting because they could do things acoustically.
Like
the third album, okay. Yeah. And they could just be heavy as all hell, like something like the fourth album.
Exactly.
So
let's talk about the new Yardbirds.
right. Now, in 66, Jimmy Page joined the Yardbirds. He replaced Paul Samwell Smith on bass. And eventually, very soon, he would switch over to guitar, and him and Beck would have that trade-off lead guitar situation. They recorded an album called Little Games in 1967, which did very well. They toured the United States on a very successful tour. They were performing some songs that later would be included in Zeppelin's lineup. Okay, one would be Dazed and Confused. Okay, Jimmy Page already had a version of that the Yardbirds had started doing. Another track would be the cover of Train Kept a Rollin' by Johnny Burnett.
Yeah.
Now, in April of 68, the Yardbirds were in New York City, and they recorded at Columbia Studios some tracks, one called Knowing That I'm Losing You. That would later be Tangerine.
Yeah.
By Led Zeppelin. So. Now, the Yardbirds in 68, that tour would prove to be kind of the end of the band, okay? Drummer Jim McCarty and vocalist Keith Relf wanted to go in a more acoustic folk rock direction. They would eventually start a band called Together. And Page wanted to continue on with this heavy blues rock thing that he was doing and they were doing in the band. Beck was gone at that point. He had gone solo at that point. They also had a new manager named Peter Grant. And originally, the plan was to start a supergroup with Jeff Beck back in the fold, Keith Moon from The Who, John Entwistle from The Who, okay, and possibly Steve Winwood or Steve Marriott from The Small Faces on vocals.
Wow, that's big.
Now, that would have been huge had it happened. Unfortunately, it didn't. But what did come out of that concept was a recording session with Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, and Keith Moon entitled Beck's Bolero. That's the track they got out of that. Now, they also had brought in John Paul Jones for that session to play bass and keyboards. So it was kind of like a pre-Led Zeppelin. Also, what came out of those recording sessions is the name, Led Zeppelin. All right. Keith Moon and them were sitting around discussing names of a band and joking around. Moon said, oh, well, this project's going to go down like a lead balloon. And at first, Page was like, that's a great name for a band. And they threw it around. And instead of balloon, they came up with Zeppelin. They thought it would sound cool with Zeppelin. So and then they changed it to LED because they didn't want anybody to be mistaken and say lead. Okay, so Led Zeppelin, all right? So the Yardbirds were falling apart, and their final gig would be July 14th, 1968, at the Luton College of Technology in Bedfordshire in England. The band, Relf would leave, McCarty would leave. Bassist Chris Dreya was left, and Jimmy Page. Now, they were still committed to some dates in Scandinavia and a few other places.
Yeah.
And Page and Dreya decided to put a new lineup together. Now, here's where it's interesting. Page's first pick for vocalist was Terry Reid.
Wow.
Okay. Remember we talked about this in the Terry Reid podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Terry Reid is, everybody should look into him. He's an amazing artist, guitar player, singer, songwriter. Really kind of, part of his legacy is he went down as the guy who refused to be the vocalist for Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
Yeah, but, at the time, if you look at the context of it, at the time, he had just come out with a solo album, and he was up and coming, and it just didn't make sense to join a band.
Yeah, he just wanted to do his own thing, right. Like, I'm doing this, I got these projects, and I think in his case, probably joining the band would have been, it would have been a step back.
That's how he viewed it. And he was another guy who played with a lot of people, like Page. So I think he was into doing his own thing. He's still around today. He played in the fall and at the Cutting Room. He's still around.
You know what's funny? Jimmy Page could have never joined a band, and he could have played for different people and made a good career out of that, just playing for different bands,
He was making money doing that, and he was well-respected, and he could have. But I think getting in the Yardbirds, and at first he refused to get in the Yardbirds when Clapton had left.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, Beck got in, and That was for a while. And then you had Beck and Paige for a while. And then yeah. Beck would leave and you had just Paige. And I think at that point, Paige was like, I like being in a band, you know, and he was starting to have some creative control and things like that.
Yeah.
So Terry Reid refused. And he said to Paige, he said, sorry, I can't do it, but I know a guy in a band called Band of Joy. That's very good. They just broke up, basically, named Robert Plant. And he suggested him. So, you know, he checked them out, thought he was fantastic. Plant accepted the role right away in the band. And they still needed the drummer.
Mm.
Okay. They actually had John Paul Jones at that point also. Jimmy Page called him. He knew him. Drea had dropped out at that point too. Okay. He didn't want to be in it anymore.
Yeah.
So John Bonham joins at the, you know, Plant brings him in because he was in Band of Joy with him. So
he wasn't a bad drummer.
Who, Bonham?
Yeah. He was a good drummer. Yeah, he was a very good drummer. That's what I'm saying. This is like a super group, if I even know it. Like, they got pieces from these groups.
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of like a super group. Not exactly what Page was thinking of, but it turned into that, you know. Now, in August of 68, the four guys played together for the first time in a room below a record store on Gerrard Street in London. Page had suggested that they record Train Kept a Rollin', okay? And originally, that was kind of a rockabilly song done by Johnny Burnett.
Yeah.
Nod Birds had covered it. And it was at that point that Jones realized that John Bonham was an awesome drummer. He didn't know him too well, okay? But he just saw the way it all kind of came together in this small session. Now, Plant was also there, obviously, and he could play harmonica, which was something nobody was thinking about. And it was a track called Jim's Blues that Plant played harmonica on that song in this session. Now, the band completed the Scandinavian tour. They weren't called Led Zeppelin yet. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah, they were called the New Yardbirds.
They were called the New Yardbirds, but it was just kind of evolving all at the same time. They had to keep the name the Yardbirds in that sense because of the tour.
Yeah, but it's just like when bands do like a greatest album, that's the last album, just because they just got to finish these gigs because they're already committed to these gigs.
Right, right. So they were really, you know, they were the New Yardbirds. Page was the only, even though he wasn't an original Yardbird, he was only part of the Yardbirds for a short time, but he was the only guy originally there that was still in this lineup. Okay.
Yeah. How did people take him? Did they accept them?
I think they went well. Okay. The only problem was shortly. Back up a second. During this tour, they would record their first album. Okay. The first Zeppelin album. And Page, right. That's what would become that. We're still talking 1968. That album would come out in January of 69. Okay. But before they were even really Led Zeppelin, before they had a record contract, Page recorded that album using his own money. Okay. God bless you. And he recorded that album for them, you know, using his own money. Okay. Supposedly, legend has it, it was recorded and mixed in 9 days.
Wow.
Okay. Which was pretty incredible. But what had happened was, and I think it probably was a good thing because it pushed them even further to become Led Zeppelin even quicker, was Drea from the Yardbirds, the bass player, put a cease and desist order out and said, you can't be the New Yardbirds. You can't use that name. You're recording an album. You can't use that. So that's how they really became Zeppelin. Okay, they had the name. They used the New Yardbirds name on the Scandinavian dates only, and then they would change right to Zeppelin. Okay. Peter Grant, managing them, secured a $143,000 advance, which is, which in today's money is $1,203,000 from Atlantic Records in November of 68. At that time, it was the biggest deal for any new band in history. Atlantic was a label that was known mostly for blues and R&B and even jazz. Okay, that's where they got their starts. They were an American label. Yeah. But in the late 60s, Atlantic was getting very interested in signing bands from England, these blues-based bands from England that we all know, okay? An interesting anecdote is one of the biggest pop stars of the 60s out of England who was signed to Atlantic was Dusty Springfield.
Yeah.
And she was very pivotal in convincing Atlantic to sign Zeppelin, all right, and just spoke with them and insisted that they sign this band. She was recording Dusty in Memphis, which is a fantastic album. One day we should do a podcast on the making of that. Just to go off for 1 second about Dusty Springfield, she was a obviously British white singer, okay, but she had this soulful R&B sound, beautiful voice, and she was selling a lot of records at that time. And she had a lot of pull, and having her backing this was a big thing. Rumor has it, I believe it's true, but I don't know if it's totally confirmed, is that Atlantic actually signed Led Zeppelin without ever hearing them.
I believe that.
Basically just on her word alone and the way Grant could get the deal done, okay?
So they signed it with that much money, without even listening to them.
Yep. Ahmet Ertegun, who was the president of Atlantic, supposedly just signed them to this deal. Now, under the terms of the contract, this is really interesting. The band had autonomy in deciding when they would release albums, when they would tour, and they had the final say over the contents and design of each album. They would also decide how to promote each album release and which tracks to release as singles.
That's like a sweetheart deal where you think of that.
No one gets a deal like that, even an established band.
Without listening to them or without nothing. But I guess they think one, because if you look at the history of Led, they were only in two record labels. They were Swamp Song Records and Atlanta. Those are the only two people that carry them.
Well, yeah. Well, Swan Song, they would form on their own a few years after their forming.
Atlanta treated them good for them to be there that long. Think about that.
There is another label though. And started with Atlantic, they started their own company called Super Hype, which would handle all the publishing and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
That would kind of turn into Swan Song as well, I believe. Okay. Now, in the early years, like 68 to 70, they did one final tour as the new Yardbirds in the UK in October of 68. This would be right at the cusp, right before they became Zeppelin. That was at the Mayfair Ballroom in Newcastle upon the Tyne in 1968. That's actually where Eric Burdon is from the Animals.
Yeah.
Their first show as Led Zeppelin was at the University of Surrey in Battersea on October 25th. So 3 weeks later from that October 4th, they are now Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Their tour manager was named Richard Cole, who would become a major figure in the touring life of the group.
Yeah, what was his deal? Was he a friend of them, or was there a guy that he hired? Where did this guy come from?
Richard Cole was somebody I think that Grant had confidence in. I mean, Grant was the manager.
Yeah.
Okay. So I honestly don't know a lot about Cole. I just know that he was their tour manager and organized this first North American tour.
Just being able to organize a tour like that for a band that nobody really heard, you know, like they only seen and they were probably like underground tapes of them and stuff like that. Like everything else, you know how it is.
Well, one thing that was in the contract, too, that I failed to mention a minute ago is Grant didn't want them to do TV appearances, which was kind of a, an odd decision to make at the time, because, you know, you get a lot of exposure. But he felt the band was so good live that you had to see them live. Otherwise, it just wasn't worth it. So they did very, very few television appearances in their career.
You know what? That's kind of genius.
It is, especially for the time, because it really went against the grain, and it created this kind of mystery around them.
Yeah.
And, you know, his thing was, we're just going to break attendance sales. They would break record sales too. Okay. Yeah. But attendance sales, and they did. Okay. I mean, the touring in their whole career was insane.
Yeah. Right?
So their debut album, which would be released on January 12th of 1969. That's it right there. It had the Hindenburg exploding, the famous picture from 1937. That caused a little controversy, that album cover. There were people still around from the Hindenburg that were a little offended by that. You know, I guess it was only 30 years later.
Yeah.
So the album peaked at number 10 on the Billboard charts. And it was released in the UK on March 31st, and it peaked at number 6 there. So according to Steve Earlywine, okay, the album's memorable guitar riffs, lumbering rhythms, psychedelic blues, groovy, bluesy shuffles, and hints of English folk music made it a significant turning point in the evolution of hard rock and heavy metal. Steve Earlywine is a critic, okay, and that kind of goes back to what you were saying before, you know, the idea of them, the originators of heavy metal with hints of this bluesy stuff. I mean, people, to be honest with you, Rob, the critics weren't crazy about Zeppelin, especially early on. Okay.
I can see that.
They really panned the first album. Okay. Still sold like a motherfucker. Didn't matter. Okay.
You know what? I think, again, they're critics. Everybody, you know, it's like this time a critic look at a movie and totally shit on a movie. You look at the movie, you're like, it's great.
Right, right. Now, one place that they played in that first tour was the Fillmore East in New York City.
Yeah, that's a big
place. I've met people that have been to that show, those shows, and they said it was just fucking mind-blowing, okay? I mean, I can't imagine seeing them in such a, you know, a small venue like the Fillmore East was, you know? But they would tour the United States, and they would also tour the UK, all right, in that they actually completed in the first year 4 US tours and 4 UK tours.
That's, like, pretty much unbelievable. That means they must have been on the road, like, the whole year, like, every year for whatever.
Now at the time, Page, who was writing most of the music, Plant was writing a lot of the lyrics, they had a lot of songs ready to go, but they just didn't have the time to stop the tours. So they recorded here and there as they toured. Okay. And they managed to get Led Zeppelin II, the second album, recorded in 1969 and released by the end of the year, which, you know, hey, look, anytime somebody puts two albums out in 1 year, that's always impressive.
That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, the first album was groundbreaking, absolutely groundbreaking. But it was this album that really broke the door open for them, especially in the States, because it had a whole lot of love on it.
Yep.
Okay. And again, it was an album developed mostly in a blues rock style. Okay. But it was very brutal, very heavy, very direct in its sound and bombastic. Okay. Again, some people were saying and continue to say that this album also is a beginning of heavy metal, if you want to call it that. Okay. I watched a documentary. You know, I always immerse myself in whatever we're going to talk about. And I watched a documentary last night about them. And Chris Needs, the famous British rock journalist, was being interviewed. And he mentioned when this came out how mind-blowing it was, because Whole Lot of Love, which if you listen to that song, it's just
that's a great song.
I mean, you know, it's what is it, fucking 7 minutes long?
I don't know.
Yeah, you got all that break in the middle with all that stuff going on.
Yeah.
And you know, he's playing the guitar with the bow and the whole thing. And he said he would walk. He said he loved the album, and he said it was bizarre because he would walk into his local pub, and there would be just a, you know, bunch of old men drinking in there, and it'd be on the jukebox, like that. Like he'd walk in at that part, you know, of the song, and he said it was just like weird, you know, but because that's how popular it was, you know, it was just everywhere. And one thing that I mentioned about the control that the band had in their record contract was about singles. They didn't release a lot of singles. They only released a handful. They didn't. The way that Peter Grant wanted to show the band to the world is to have them be album oriented. Okay. Every album should be listened to from beginning to end. No singles really. Okay. They would relent on that a few times and release a few things. One thing that they released in at the end of 1969, kind of like they didn't want to release it, but they did, was a radio friendly version of Whole Lot of Love. I mean, the song is 8 minutes long. It couldn't be played on pop radio. It was too long.
They probably did like a 5 minute release.
Yeah. They cut it down to about, you know, 4 minutes or so, which was kind of long even for a single.
Yeah.
And it got played and did very well. Okay. It actually, I believe it went top 10, I believe.
Yeah, you kind of had to do that because radio was such a thing that you had to put songs on the radio just to get a little exposure.
Right. But, you know, they were still not doing TV shows, not in the United States, okay? And they were really just touring constantly. That was the way you were going to see Led Zeppelin. So following the release of the second album, Zeppelin would complete several more U.S. tours. They played initially in clubs and ballrooms, but then larger auditoriums were taking them in. And then what was happening is they were starting to be known to play for 3-4 hours.
Yeah.
Okay. And they would never play the song the same twice. Okay. Interestingly, they're one of the most bootleg bands of all time too.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is, you know, for me, I mean, I used to buy a lot of bootlegs back in the day. I did have a couple of Zeppelin ones on cassette, and I remember different versions of this song, hearing it over, you know, two nights in a row, totally. Yeah. Okay. So, also, they were getting to be known as pretty wild.
Yeah.
Okay. This tour of this second album kind of solidified them as like maniacs. Okay. You know, there was the story of the Hyatt House in California, Hollywood, where, you know, they would rent out 1, 2, 3 floors, take over the whole place, the debauchery, the stories of John Bonham riding his motorcycle through the hotel. There's a story. I don't know if it's ever been debunked, crazy, but there's a story with supposedly, I think it's Page and Plant inserting a sand shark into a woman. Okay. A sand shark, which is about this big. Okay, it's not big, but still.
You know, I never seen Led Zeppelin, but I saw Page and Plant at Madison Square Garden. And believe it or not, they played a lot of Zed Zeppelin stuff. It was incredible. Like, they just went off.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty freaking incredible show. They played like for 3.5 hours almost.
Yeah. I mean, this was the time they were getting to be known for that. You know, they had so much material and, you know, they could play some, you know, so much acoustic, electric, whatever, you know, and they were really just becoming like the live act to see.
Yeah.
So in 1970, Page and Plant retired to the Bron Eor, which was, if I'm pronouncing that right, that's a cottage in Wales. And it was there they were going to work on Led Zeppelin 3. Now, this album was going to be different. They wanted it to be much more acoustic, okay, which they were taking a chance doing that, okay? They were known as a heavy band. So to do something acoustic, and actually the acoustic stuff that they were doing was very influenced by Celtic music. Okay. So they felt it would show that they could be versatile.
Yeah,
it did. It worked. The album's rich acoustic sound initially received mixed reactions, but fans, surprised at the turn of the events, really went out and, you know, supported it. Okay. It also impressed the critics. Okay. And they started to get a lot more good press with this album.
Well, what happened with them with the immigrant song? They didn't want that song to be released in the right away, right?
They didn't want it to be released as a single.
Okay.
Okay. Immigrant song is on Led Zeppelin 3. Okay.
Yeah.
It's the opening track. And in the U.S., Atlantic released it against their wishes as a single. It kind of went against the contract. And it actually went to the top 20. Okay. What's that?
It did good then.
Yeah.
But I think that's not you released that song first, Mike, and then you might be interested in what the rest of the album's going to sound like. You know, I don't think sometimes singles are that bad to release, you know?
You know, I'll agree with you from a standing point of music in the 60s and even music now, okay?
Yeah.
But music in the 70s, aside from Led Zeppelin, was becoming more album-oriented.
Oh, of course.
It wasn't so much about the single anymore. FM radio really changed that, Rob, okay? When FM radio started in the late 60s, they only played, and not everybody had FM, okay?
Yeah.
If you had it, it was a lot of college radio stations were FM. They played deep cuts. They played album cuts. They played entire album sides. They didn't play the single. They do three in a row from the same album, you know, whatever. Okay. They were getting, you know, this industry was kind of getting away from the single when it came to rock and roll a little bit. Okay. Zeppelin didn't want really much to do with singles. They had their idea of we're going to be an album oriented band. I like that concept. I think for them it worked, but it didn't matter because when they released the singles, they all did well.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
that's,
it wasn't like
why would you argue when the singles are going to do good regardless if you want it or not? So
yeah, I don't know how much this was a big thing. I think Grant was, look, I mean, you could do a whole podcast on Peter Grant. I mean, the guy was a maniac. Okay, he was a fucking gangster practically. Okay, but he has the fourth album cover.
Yeah,
the you know, Peter Grant, I mean, just talk about him for a second. I mean, the way this guy managed this band was just nuts. Okay. People were scared of him. He was tall, heavy, bearded guy, long hair. He was just like very imposing. Like when he talked, he hovered over you.
And he probably looked like Tony Soprano talking.
Bigger than Tony Soprano. Yeah. And I mean, there's stories where people was so intimidated by him, if they even got a phone call from him, they would stand up like they're talking to God. You know what I mean? It just was, you know, he was, I mean, then there's so many things, you know, how, if he was crooked or not crooked, I don't know. There's a great book called Hammer of the Gods, which tells the story of Led Zeppelin. A lot of it is legend. A lot of it is, there's fact in there too. There's a mix. It's a great book to read if you want to get into it. It's famous. It's been out for 40 years, that book came out already. Now, between 1970 and 75, there's no doubt that Led Zeppelin was the biggest rock band in the world. Okay.
Yeah.
They reached new heights of commercial success, critical success. They were eclipsing anybody around them. Okay. And basically, it was Zeppelin and the rest of the music industry. Okay. The band's image also was beginning to change at the time, okay? They started wearing flamboyant clothing. Paige would wear stuff like these suits with, like, moons and stars on them and stuff. He looked cool as fuck, okay? And they started using laser light shows and and special mirrors and lightings. These were things never done before. Okay,
Zeppelin. These guys started becoming more like entertainers. Like, you know, we need to entertain the public. We need to play our music, but we also got to put on a good show so people can sit here for 3 hours, 4 hours. That's
right. Right, right. And it was also this time where, you know, they were taking quite advantage of their huge success. And like I said, all the excess and craziness that's legendary these days, they also were flying around in a Boeing 720. Okay. That said Led Zeppelin on it, and it was a huge plane. They used to call it the Starship. Okay, that was the nickname for it. Basically, the next thing they had to do after making this third, more mellow acoustic album was come out with something heavier.
Yeah.
They had to kick it back in. So Led Zeppelin 4, they call it that. It really was untitled.
Yeah, that's
what I really had no title. Was released on November 8th, 1971. Some people call it Led Zeppelin 4. Some people call it Zoso because there's the symbols on there. Zoso was actually Jimmy Page's symbol. There was a symbol for each of them. They felt that giving it an untitled name or leaving it untitled was just about getting rid of the hype. It kind of symbolized getting rid of the hype around the band. Okay. So the record company, however, wanted something on the cover. They were just going to have a blank cover, basically. So they decided they would have these four symbols to represent the four members of the band. This album sold 37 million copies, Rob.
That's huge.
Huge. One of the best-selling albums of all time.
That is huge.
And just by that album alone, it cemented them as, you know, the biggest band of the 70s. Okay. Now, what's on that album? Black Dog, Rock and Roll, okay, Battle of Evermore, and of course, Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you know, we could talk for half an hour about that song.
That song might be the most overplayed song ever, and that's probably one of the songs most recorded. Other people record, artists record.
Yeah, and in the 1970s, it was the most requested song on any radio station, rock radio station. Okay, so, you know, that, and did you know it was never released as a single?
I believe that.
Okay, it was never released as a single, but it was the most played and most requested song on rock radio in the 1970s.
Hey, you know what? Probably a bunch of people probably bought the album just because of that one song. I guarantee you.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. And another long one, 8 minutes long, okay, was Stairway to Heaven. And, you know, again, back in my younger days, it was a song I would turn the fuck off. Okay. It didn't do anything for me. Okay. That song. It still kind of really doesn't. I respect it for what it is. I imagine that, you know, Page and Plant play it today out of necessity whenever they do play it.
But, yeah,
you know, they have to play it.
But you know what's really interesting about these guys? The Beatles had that record in Shea Stadium forever, and to Led Zeppelin shattered the record.
Yeah, actually, if you remember, no, it wasn't. It was Grand Funk Railroad. Grand Funk Railroad beat that Shea Stadium record.
Oh,
remember?
I know that Zeppelin also beat the Beatles record.
I think they might have beat them in other places. I don't know if they played Shea Stadium.
They played the Beatles Shea Stadium because the grossing tour. Because they played Tampa Bay. They
okay.
Played a sold out show in Madison Square
yes,
Garden.
Yes, I'm confused for a second. They did play them. Okay. And they beat that 60, but that was in 1973. Right. And I think Grand Funk had actually beat it before that. So I think they actually, you know, it was really them beating Grand Funk in a sense. You know what I'm saying? But still, they did beat the Beatles at Shea Stadium. You're right. Now, you know, what do you do after such a huge album like this? 1972, 73.
You go on vacation.
Well, you make another record, okay?
You know, it's amazing how many records they took out.
I mean, they just pumped them out. I mean, you got to respect that, okay? Nobody even does that today at all, okay? Somebody at that caliber doesn't have, I mean, who's at their caliber today? Not really many.
Nobody. Okay? Like, there's people that take an album and then you won't hear for a few years.
Yeah, because they all got to do whatever they do. But so anyway, the next album will be called Houses of the Holy, and that was released in March of 73. Strange album cover right there, right?
Yeah.
So that there was a lot more experimentation with this album. They were using synthesizers and mellotrons. Okay. Oh, one thing I wanted to just mention, and I didn't know this until I was researching it. I always wondered how they played Stairway to Heaven live, okay? Because you have that flute part, okay? You never see anybody playing the flute.
No.
Okay? So I was watching, you know, in prepping for the show, I watched the documentary, and I also watched The Song Remains the Same, which is still amazing. Okay.
Yeah, great song.
And, I mean, the live stuff in that is epic. And, you know, you see John Paul Jones shift over to the mellotron, which is kind of like a keyboard, okay?
Yeah.
And he's playing that part, and there's the flute also. And it turns out they actually used backing tapes. They might have been one of the first bands to ever do that.
Yeah.
Don't quote me. I'm not positive. I'm just guessing. But I think that they might have been because, you know, to recreate that live would be almost impossible. They had to have some kind of backing track.
Let me tell you, I saw the Smashing Pumpkins about maybe 7 years ago in Madison Square Garden. They did a great rendition of Stairway to Heaven. It was pretty fantastic. Like, Billy Corgan got that voice.
Billy Corgan, yeah.
And he's singing that. It was pretty incredible. It was like, holy moly. He did the song. He did the justice.
Did they ever record that, or is that just something they did live?
I think that's something they did live. They might have recorded. Don't quote me. They might have recorded, but I know they did it in the concert.
I have to look that up. I'd like to hear that.
And now, it was a great version that they did live at Madison Square Garden. And
sure.
He also did like a David Bowie song, so he played for 2-3 covers.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. I'm going to look that up. Now, Houses of the Holy, like I just said, kind of had a strange album cover. It's kind of like an orange looking cover. Right. And you know what these kids are like, these children are climbing. You know what that is?
What?
It's the Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland. Remember we did a conspiracy show on that?
Yeah.
Okay. They're actually crawling up those rocks that look like it was formed like a bridge.
Yeah. It's fucking weird.
Yeah. 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 There was actually their name was not even on the cover of the album. You noticed that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That was intentional. All right. And the album title was only printed on the sleeve inside. So you didn't even know what it was.
You didn't even know. You just saw it. And
yeah.
But with that track record that they got.
Right. Right.
You know.
Now,
anything they released was pretty much gold.
Right. Exactly. I mean, they didn't even have to have their name on the cover. So Houses of the Holy would top the charts worldwide, and the band would once again go on a huge concert tour of North America in 73. Broke all these records, okay, like we were just talking about before. Tampa Stadium in Florida, they played to 56,800 fans. That was a breaking record for that place. They broke the record for gross tickets at Shea Stadium for $309,000. All right, which was a lot of money back then. Three sold-out shows at Madison Square Garden in New York City were filmed for a motion picture in that year in 73, but they would be held back a little bit. That movie would eventually be The Song Remains the Same and come out in 1976. And the last night of the three nights, I believe it was a Sunday night, and it's the famous incident where they got robbed from their hotel of $180,000 out of the hotel safe. Okay. Now, you know, again, this is another Peter Grant event. Okay. where, you know, he made a huge thing about it. They got ripped off $108,000, which today would be over $1 million if it was in counting inflation.
I don't think they got robbed. I think just publicity stunt. Peter Grant being, you know.
That, well, a lot of people have said a lot of things. And he was questioned. He was questioned by police. Yeah, no. He got taken down to headquarters politely and answered questions. And so did a bunch of people, but they never found the money.
Wow.
They never found the money. Now, you know, why would Peter Grant steal that money? Well, a million reasons. I mean, you know, it was probably box office stuff, box office, and they could say maybe get away with not paying taxes or something. Who knows?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was at the Drake Hotel in Manhattan where they were staying. And up until that point, I don't recall if this has ever been beaten, but that was the most ever stolen out of a hotel safe in New York City history. I don't know if that's ever been beaten since. I don't think so. Okay. Now, in 1974, a year later, Led Zeppelin took a break from touring, okay, and they launched their own record label called Swan Song. And that was named after an unreleased track that they had. The record's label logo is that winged person, supposed to be Icarus falling from the sky, okay? That logo would become their logo, basically. You'd see it on T-shirts and posters. I mean, I knew a million people with that Swan Song poster hanging in their room with the black light on it and all that shit. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, T-shirts and everything.
So let me tell you, at this point, I guess Atlanta Record must have been disappointed to lose it. They were probably the biggest.
No. They didn't sign themselves to Swan Song. They were still on Atlantic. Okay. What they were doing was they were signing other people.
Okay. So
they signed Bad Company.
Yeah.
Okay. Bad Company was forming.
Pretty Things.
Right. The Pretty Things, who'd been around for a while and needed a new label. A band called Maggie Bell. Okay. The actual label only lasted 3 years. 3 years after they disbanded. By the early 80s, they were gone.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That was just something they did for themselves. It wasn't there. They were still on Atlantic, being distributed by Atlantic and all that. Now, in 1975, they would come out with Physical Graffiti. Now, we did a podcast on this about a year and a half ago, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we go into a lot of detail on the making of this album. You should go back and check it out. It's a double album. It's 15 songs. And 8 of them was recorded at Headley Grange in 1974. And then 7 had actually been recorded earlier. I think it's their masterpiece.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was it like a double album? Was it more like, because there were a lot of songs and the songs were long. Was it like a quadruple album almost?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could look at it like that. But it's only 15 songs.
Yeah.
You know, so to me, there are a lot of songs on there, and Cashmere is on there, and all that. But
yeah, like in my time of dying, it's 11 minutes long, and yes, then you have.
I think that's their longest song.
Cuts to Pie, like just between that, you got a 20-minute.
Right. It had to be at least 2 albums to do that. You know.
Yeah.
So
this is like Cashmere. It's 8 minutes and 30. It's like there's a lot of shit on this shit. This was a great album, I gotta tell you.
Yeah, I love it. I listen to it quite a bit. Now, at this point in 1975, when this album came out, they were now considered like the world's best rock band. All right, they kind of displaced the Who. They displaced the Rolling Stones. It was a massive commercial and critical success. And it actually was so successful that all the previous albums jumped back into the top 200. Okay, so when that happens, that's always pretty amazing. We talked about AC/DC recently, right?
Yeah.
Back in Black, with the earlier albums coming back because of it. Very similar.
Did you see that this year for a Christmas song, I think Frank Sinatra was back at the top 20? Do you see that?
After what?
After years, one of his Christmas songs was in the top 20, Frank Sinatra.
This last Christmas?
So yeah, it was this past. He had one song that Sinatra, that he hasn't been in the top 20 like ridiculous. I get like something like 60, like whatever, how many years. That was some weird thing. But it makes Frank Sinatra. I forgot which Christmas song it was.
I'm not surprised, man, because I didn't hear that, but I believe it. I'm not surprised.
And Mariah was number one. The most overplayed. Oh. What I want was the most overplayed song.
No, I mean, let's just say this. Old music and old artists, I think starting about at least 5 years ago, are outselling new people.
Yeah.
Okay. There is such a, you know, a clamor for people to hear this old music. That's why tribute bands are so huge now.
Yeah.
Okay. Tribute bands are as big now, bigger than they ever been, because people want to hear these old bands, you know?
Yeah.
And they can't hear them because they're gone, or they're retired, or too many guys in the bands are dead. Okay.
Yeah.
But the music can still be played, and that's you know, it's kind of sad state of affairs for music. But yeah,
look what Guardians of the Galaxy did. They got volume 1, 2, and 3. What were the songs? They were all old school, like R&B, rock and roll song, and those albums hit to number, like they hit the top 10. And they also had songs that you haven't heard a year that were hitting the top 10, because people are like, oh, this is great, but they never heard it.
Right. Now, in May of 75, getting back to the physical graffiti era, okay, they played 5 sold-out nights at the Earl's Court Arena in London, which at the time was the biggest arena that London had, okay? So I believe it was before Wembley and all that, okay? Oh, no, is Wembley in London? I'm not even sure. But it was the biggest arena that they had at the time. So they did 5 sold-out nights there. Now, following that, they took a holiday and they planned an autumn tour in America. They planned 2 open air dates in San Francisco. Okay. In August of 75, however, Plant and his wife Maureen were involved in a serious car crash. They were on the island of Rhodes in Greece. Okay. And Plant had suffered a broken ankle and some other injuries, and Maureen was badly injured. In fact, she was so badly injured that had she not received a blood transfusion that she got, she would have died. Okay. Yeah. So they had to take a break with this. Now unable to tour, Plant would head to the Channel Island of Jersey. That's one of the Channel Islands off of England, to spend August and September recuperating. He was there with Bonham and Page. Okay. They then reconvened in Malibu, California. Now, during this forced hiatus where they had to be doing nothing, basically, much of the material for the next album, which would be Presence, was written. Okay. What do you got there? A montage.
Yeah, I got the Presence right in the corner. You see?
Oh, yeah. I see it right there. Okay.
Top left. I just couldn't find that by itself.
Okay. Anyway, that's what it looked like. Now, this time we know Led Zeppelin was the world's number one rock show attraction. Okay. They outsold every band of its time, including the Rolling Stones at that point. Okay. Now, Presence, which was released in March of 76, marked a pretty big drastic change for the band as far as sound. It was more straightforward guitar-based jams. It departed from the acoustic ballads and intricate arrangements that they had in the past. It was a platinum seller, but it received kind of mixed reviews among fans and critics. It did very well. People were kind of yes and no with it. Page at this point,
I don't think this was one of the better albums. I thought it was a good album, but it's like one that if I didn't hear it, it's not like I'm missing anything. I hate to say that.
Yeah, I'm not in love with it. I think most people will agree with that. I think In Through the Outdoor is a little bit better. Okay, the next one. But, I mean, to me, I rarely listen to that later period. Like, I kind of stop after Physical Graffiti, you know, and I don't really listen to the last, like, 2, 3 that they got. But what was happening at this time, the excesses were getting out of control with the band. And, you know, Page was deep in a heroin habit. Okay. Bonham was deep into his alcoholism. Everybody was dabbling with something. Okay. I think Plant was probably the most sober, though he was known to partake. But he was actually recovering at this time. He was in a wheelchair. He was recorded presence in a wheelchair, basically, because he couldn't walk with the broken ankle. They didn't tour that year, 1976. I think that was the first year that they really didn't tour at all. But what they did put out was the movie, The Song Remains the Same. Okay, and then that came with an accompanying soundtrack that topped the charts. Okay. It was premiered in New York City on October 20th, 1976. It got a lukewarm reception by critics and fans, but over time it would become, you know, a cult favorite. I saw it many times in the 80s as the midnight movie to go see.
Another bad midnight movie.
In a theater, like, you know, playing like something like they used to do with Rocky Horror. You know, they'd have Song Remains the Same. When The Wall came out in, I think it was 1980, that was another one, Pink Floyd, The Wall, that movie. You know, these. Remember when, before video, you had the midnight movie in the movie theater? You know?
Yeah, of course.
And that became one of those things. The movie didn't do well in the UK for some reason. They actually hadn't toured the UK since 1975. Because of their tax exile status, there were like two tours in that time that they had to skip the UK. And
didn't the Rolling Stone do the same thing?
Yeah, a few years earlier. Okay, the 70s in the UK economically was a disaster for anybody if you were making any money at all. They were taking it all. Okay, so during this period, they would take this break. The movie would be out. They would still be in the public conscience to some degree. But then in 1977, they decided to embark on Plant was walking again. They would embark on another major concert tour of the United States and the rest of North America. It's this tour set an attendance record. 76,229 people at the Silver Dome concert on the 30th of April. Okay. I don't even know where that is. Where is the Silver Dome? Do you know?
The Pontiac Superdome, is that it? Is it Michigan or Detroit?
Might be. Look it up if you can, okay?
Over
76,000 people were in that audience.
That was where WrestleMania 3 was.
There was an incident in Cincinnati at Riverfront Coliseum where fans broke down the doors to get in, okay? Two sold-out concerts for that date. They were throwing rocks and bottles and cans at people. Broke through some glass doors.
Silverdome. That's in
Silverdome.
Yeah, Silverdome. I think it's definitely Michigan.
Okay.
Pontiac,
Michigan.
Yeah, that's like they did WrestleMania there, which is funny, which broke every attendance. So well, for Led Zeppelin, that's a huge arena, man. That's like
76,229 people were in that arena.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
On June 3rd of that year, a concert at Tampa Stadium was cut short because of a severe thunderstorm, despite tickets indicating rain or shine, and a riot broke out. Okay, because they were saying rain or shine, you got to play anyway. Okay, and it resulted in arrests and injuries and. Things were getting a little crazy. So after a July 23rd show at the Day on the Green Festival at the Oakland Coliseum in Oakland, California, Bonham and members of Led Zeppelin's support staff were arrested after a member of promoter Bill Graham's staff was badly beaten during the band's performance.
Wow.
The following day's second Oakland concert was the group's final live appearance in the United States, though. Okay. 2 days later, as they checked in at a French Quarter hotel for their July 30th performance at the Louisiana Superdome, Plant received news that his five-year-old son, Carrick, had died from a stomach virus. The rest of the tour was immediately canceled, prompting widespread speculation about Led Zeppelin's future. Now, one thing I'm going to mention briefly, I don't want to get into this too much, is there's always been that thing about Page being into the occult and all that. And he was, probably still is, for all I know. Okay. He was living in Aleister Crowley's mansion on Loch Ness. He had bought it. Okay. He was into that stuff. There's an interesting, I read, it was in a rock magazine. I don't remember which one off the top of my head. Could have been Cream or something like that, where Plant actually blamed Page for the death of his son due to like all this occult shit that he was into. It's interesting. It's never brought up anymore. I don't know. I mean, it was a quote in an interview, so he must have said it. Okay,
he probably fell into place. Either do this or fuck you.
Yeah, I don't know. And I always wish there was more of a story with that. You know what I mean? Did they have a falling out with each other? Obviously not. They still play together. They're still friends.
Yeah.
But he felt that there was something to that.
Okay, but they did a picture with Page with that lady devil worshiper, the older stars are connected to, and they have that real party where they eat a human. They looks like a human being.
Oh, Maria Abramovich or whatever her name is.
Yeah, they have been picture of him, and so you know it's a little truth to the him and the
occult. Yeah, no, he was definitely dabbling. That's well known. Okay, dabbling in the occult, but I always thought that was such a strange thing for a lead singer to say about his guitarist in an interview. Okay, I read it, so I don't, and I never heard it get elaborated on. So if anyone's got any info about that, let us know.
It was probably something that was saved once and left alone. Let's not touch it.
Right. Now, in November of 1978, the group recorded at Polar Studios in Stockholm, Sweden. The resulting album would be In Through the Outdoor, which was another experimental album that kind of got mixed reactions out of people. But nevertheless, the album got to number one. You're gonna show it there, In Through the Outdoor?
Is that the one?
No.
That was the
one with the people at the table.
Yeah, yeah, but this was the outside cover of the album. When you bought this album, came to that. Then you had it, because it had like six covers. So this is one of the covers.
Oh, okay. Now, with the album's release, Led Zeppelin's entire catalog got back into the top 200. That seems to be a recurring theme then. In August of 1979, after two warm-up shows in Copenhagen, Zeppelin headlined two concerts at Nebworth Music Festival, playing to a crowd of approximately 104,000 people on the first night. A brief low-key European tour was undertaken in June and July of 1980, featuring a very stripped-down set without the usual lengthy jams and solos. On June 27th, at a show in Nuremberg, Germany, the concert came to an abrupt halt in the middle of the third song as John Bonham collapsed while playing. Okay, he was rushed to the hospital, and the band claimed that he had eaten like some bad bananas or something. Okay, but you know the result was really from excessive alcohol. All right. A North American tour, the band's first since 1977, was scheduled to start on October 17th in 1980. Tragedy would strike here. Okay. On September 24th, Bonham was picked up by Led Zeppelin assistant Rex King to attend rehearsals at Bray Studios for the tour. During the journey by car, Bonham asked if they could stop for breakfast. Now, his breakfast consisted of a ham roll and four quadruple vodkas. That's some lumped up shit right there.
That is lumped up.
Okay. He continued. That's just to start the day. Now, he continued to drink heavily after getting to the studio. And by the evening, the rehearsals were stopped. and the band retired to Page's house, which was the old mill house in Clewer, Windsor, one of a few houses he had. All right. And here's where tragedy strikes, because after midnight, Bonham, who had fallen asleep, was taken to bed physically, okay, placed on his side, and at 1:45 p.m. the next day, probably 12 hours later, Benji Lefebvre, which was Led Zeppelin's new tour manager, okay, and John Paul Jones found Bonham dead in the bed. The cause of death was asphyxiation from vomit. He choked on his own vomit. They called the death accidental. And an autopsy found that there was no other recreational drugs in his body. Now, although he had recently begun to take something called Modafinil, which was kind of a combination of an antipsychotic and antidepressant, because he had a lot of anxiety that he suffered from. It's unclear if these substances interacted with the alcohol and caused him to pass away like that. Basically, he vomited in his while he was unconscious and choked on it. Okay. Bonham's remains would be cremated and his ashes interred on October 12, 1980 at Rushock Parish Church in Worcester. The planned North American tour was canceled.
Worcester is where they do the Worcester sauce.
Could be. Probably. Probably was invented there. So the tour for America got canceled. And despite the rumors that Cozy Powell, Carmine Appice, Barrymore Barlow, Simon Kirk, Rick Lee, or Bev Bevan would join the group. Okay, these were all well-established drummers. The band decided to break up. They just said they couldn't go on without him. They put it on December 4th. They waited to put out a press statement and said that we wish it to be known that the loss of our dear friend and the deep sense of undivided harmony felt by ourselves and our manager have led us to decide that we could not continue as we were. The statement was simply signed Led Zeppelin. So that's the story of the band, but that thing doesn't end there.
Okay. Yeah.
And part two. Coming up in 2 weeks, we're going to talk about the aftermath of this. We're going to talk about the legacy of this band, what it's meant to the world. I mean, there's a whole other chapter here that we're going to talk about. You know, I'm just going to say something. It's such a shocking end. You know, it's almost like a car hitting a brick wall, because I always wondered what they would have become.
But you know what, Mike? I think it was like, I know it ended tragic, but it was almost like a blessing in the sky. How long can they go doing this thing without somebody else getting killed or more drugs abuse and stuff? So it's good that the band took like a small break away after this tragic. And, you know, they just started doing their own things, you know, because it wasn't like the end of Zeppelin, but there was a few reunion. Like they got back together. They never got back together, but they did a few reunion shows.
Yeah.
And then you got the Page and Plan tour, which was fantastic. But you know what? I think after that, you could never have Led Zeppelin again if Bob wasn't in it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it was a classy move to end it. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, to show to their friend that they couldn't continue on without them in the same way. It would never be the same anyway. So they probably figured that. Go out while you're on top. You know, but
if Bob of Plan would have died, it would have definitely be the end.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't.
You can never have. But, you know, you had the drummer, you still have the lead singer, but you had to end it there. It's like, it was very, very classy. It's a good way to end their legacy.
Now, I don't know if you remember this, but when John Bonham died, they actually announced it in my school.
Oh, I didn't get that.
I got that. They made an announcement in school that he died. I was like, holy shit. I think I was like in seventh grade or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So, all right. So, Rob, let's give our handles. Where can we find you?
Facebook, Instagram, and X, formerly known as Twitter. You can find me at Getting Lumped Up. Just put in Getting Lumped Up, and you can find the website and all my handles on there. Mike, where can we find you?
Oh, okay. I'm on Facebook under Rocco Mike. And of course, we got the Rock Show podcast group page on Facebook. Please subscribe and post music and talk about rock and roll, anything you want. We're very active on there. We're still about 2,000 members, a little more than that now.
I think we got way more members. I think Facebook is just not putting them on because I think there's only amount of people you can put in a group. Then you got to start another group.
Maybe. I don't know. They also, they if you're not active, they kind of don't count you in the group, even though if you have an account.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of that. But we have well over 2,000, but I think it shows about 1,900.
Yeah.
But, if you're looking for me as Rocker Mike, you can find me RockerMike212 on Instagram, RockerMike212 on Twitter, which is X. I'm also Rocker Mike on Threads, MeWe, Getter, Truth Social. Just look under Rocker Mike, you'll find me. Definitely any, you know, any words of praise or you want to take a dump on me, I can take it. It's all right. I don't like my hat, you know, so I don't know, whatever. But we're looking forward to part two on this. We'll be there. You go. That's a hat.
I got my. This is my summer on the beach hat.
That is. That's awesome. Cool.
So,
all right, man.
People, remember to come see us in 2 weeks for part two of this great series, Led Zeppelin. And if you like the show, please give us a like, subscribe, and please leave a comment because we'd love to hear your comment. And Mike is pretty good at getting people back in the comment. I'm horrible. I'm way too lumped up most of the time.
I'm retired now. You're still working. I got all the time in the world to talk to people.
So remember, people, don't get drunk.
Get lumped up.
And we see you in 2 weeks.
Take care, people.
I want to get lumped up tonight. Listen to Rob Ross and get rock on my